This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
They actually were justifying their need to make money over the reality of the carnage and genocide that's being perpetuated against the Palestinian people.
The International Longshore and Warehouse Union West Coast Convention votes down a resolution calling for a boycott of military cargo to Israel to oppose genocide.
Cannot talk about Biden without talking about Menendez and the Foreign Relations Committee and how they influence and manipulate Congress and how they manipulate the White House and how they manipulate think tanks, how they manipulate corporate media to justify a regime change agenda on Cuba, even though it's outdated, even though it's racist, even though it's terrorist.
Obi Egbuna Jr. denounces the Democratic Party's policy of aggression and hostility towards Cuba.
A man literally ran for office saying, if you elect me, I'll find something to charge Trump with. To me, people got to understand that there are a lot of people that do, in fact, understand that this is lawfare and support the fact that it's lawfare.
Pacifica's Garland Nixon on lawfare against former President Trump.
The workers of this city got together and said, we're not going to take it anymore. And they organized and they were very creative about it. They fought like hell. Some of them died. It was violent, but it was strategic, and it was effective, and damn it, they won.
This year is the 90th anniversary of the Minneapolis Teamster General Strike in 1934. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The ILWU longshore workers on the West Coast have a long tradition of international solidarity, from boycotting military cargo to Chile's Pinochet dictatorship to boycotting cargo from South Africa during its apartheid regime. However, at last week's ILWU West Coast Convention in Vancouver, British Columbia, members voted down a resolution from ILWU Local 10 calling for a military boycott of cargo to Israel. Here's ILWU Local 10 retired Secretary Treasurer Clarence Thomas speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
That it's important for people to know that the resolutions that were submitted by ILWU Local 10 were all defeated resoundingly. And so it relates to the issue of Palestine, one of the most, what I would say, revealing discussion and outcome of that particular resolution had to do with the fact that the Zionist point of view, lies, misstatements, everything that is normally used in the corporate media to explain and justify genocide were the arguments that were used at the convention. So the resolution that was submitted by ILWU Local 10 was titled The War in Gaza and the West Bank. I think one of the most important things to discuss that when this resolution was introduced, a decision was made by the body only to listen to the therefore be it resolved. In other words, the resolutions were not read in its entirety. When I spoke at the mic, I expressed my dissatisfaction with that. Now, mind you, it's important for the audience to realize that I was there as a fraternal delegate because I am a member of the ILWU Pacific Coast Pensioners Association, executive board member. So I have a so-called voice, but no vote. Suffice it to say that the war in Gaza and the West Bank, the result was the ILWU will refuse to handle military cargo to Israel as requested by the PGFTU, which was seconded by NUNSA, and as our union already did in 1978, refusing to load bomb parts for Chilean military junta, and also did in 1980, refusing to load arms to the military junta of El Salvador. We will honor and picket lines with protesting the war in Gaza, and as we have done repeatedly in the past. So that was the only thing that was allowed to be heard yesterday, which was my opinion, an effort to basically minimize people's knowledge of what the resolution was all about and to vote on that. I think one of the most interesting things that happened was that members, specifically those who were directly impacted by this particular resolution, which would be folks who come from the Pacific Northwest, namely Local 23, they actually were justifying their need to make money over the reality of the carnage and genocide that's being perpetuated against the Palestinian people. Also important for me to mention that was a brother by the name Chris King. And Chris is head of the CFMEU, which stands for the Construction Forestry Maritime Employee Union. A very dynamic speaker, very militant, has 30,000 members out of Australia. And he was one of the most compelling speakers who spoke. There were others. Patty Crumlin spoke from the MUA, and also Stefan Cotton, who's from the International Transport Workers Federation. All of those individuals, during the course of their speeches, made very strong statements in support of the Palestinians, calling for a ceasefire. But in the case of Brother King, he said something that was very, very profound and received a tremendous standing ovation. And that was, peace is union business. I repeat, peace is union business. And that was preceded by remarks that he made about what was particularly occurring in Gaza, talking about, you know, how the Gazans were told to go south, go north, how they were bombed in each direction, how they set up tent cities, how that was bombed. And he described in detail the amputation of limbs of children and babies. And so when he made this statement, it was resonated throughout the whole convention, and people stood up, applauded, and all of that, which gave one some hope that there was going to be a possibility of a resolution, Local 10, that would be accepted. And I dare say that what that turned out to be was, I think that what it basically turned out to be was, people being caught in the moment. And I think that it also speaks to how people now in the ILWU, in my opinion, are no longer in any way captured or influenced by the founders of the ILWU. And what I mean by that is the issue of peace, the issue of challenging the United States government in terms of criticizing U.S. foreign policy, has been the case, the ILWU, going back to the 1930s. During my short remarks, I even pointed that out when I described how the ILWU had refused to work scrap iron, load scrap iron, and send to Japan, because the ILWU realized that Japan, being part of the Axis of Evil, could use that material against the Axis, because this was before the United States entered into World War II. And so when President Roosevelt intervened and wrote a letter to Harry Bridges, he was scolding the Harry and the ILWU and stated, I'm not quoting, that the ILWU needed to stay out of U.S. foreign policy. And Bridges' response was, that's our right. That's our duty as citizens. And so I was able to make the case that this was an example of the ILWU following the slogan of what Chris Kane said, and that is, peace is union business.
That was International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 10 retired Secretary Treasurer Clarence Thomas.
Can't you hear the urgent call of Palestine? Can't you hear the urgent call of Palestine? Palestine. Tormented, tortured, bruised and battered, and all her sons and daughters scattered. Can't you hear sing the sweet, sad voice of Palestine. Can't you hear the sweet, sad voice of Palestine? Palestine. She whispers above the roars of the guns, beckoning to
That was Zeynab Shaath, The Urgent Call of Palestine. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Next, J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio spoke to Obi Igbuna Jr. of the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association about what the corporate media is calling the Cuban Missile Crisis II, the decades-long U.S. embargo on Cuba, and the plight and status of Black Panther and Black Liberation Army exile Assata Shakur, who resides in Cuba.
You recently held a meeting where the ambassador from Cuba to the United States was speaking directly to journalists and people from community organizations around the United States, and he was talking about what was going on in Cuba. One of the things that we talked about was what the corporate media is calling the Cuban Missile Crisis II. Can you give us some kind of background? Can you give us some history? And how does Cuba see this?
It's Cold War adventurism. They say that the Cold War is over, but the strategies, the methodology, the diplomatic approach that U.S. imperialism takes to imposing their will, it's still the same. The Cuban Missile Crisis, when they threatened Cuba, that was Cold War adventurism. This is an extension of that. First of all, numerically speaking, why would a nation of 13 million people attempt to provoke a nation with 300 million people? It doesn't make mathematical sense. And remember, it was under this pretext that the Reagan administration invaded Grenada on October 19, 1983, and assassinated Maurice Bishop. They said that Grenada, an island of 88,000 citizens, was stashing weapons in the new airport that they were building, Soviet and Cuban missiles that would be aimed at the United States. Maurice Bishop came, spoke at Medgar Evers College, and told people how illogical that was. Cuba is all about defending their territorial integrity, and part of defending your territorial integrity is dealing with any propaganda that suggests that you have an appetite for war and destruction as opposed to protection of the land that isn't yours inherently.
So what exactly is going on between Cuba and the United States in Caribbean waters at this moment?
The United States trying to justify maintaining the blockade, justifying attempting to be militarily hostile, diplomatically hostile. But remember, militarism is the staple of this culture. They would love to invade Cuba militarily, but the climate diplomatically is not conducive to that. So even though the blockade established after the Bay of Pigs invasion failed in 1961, it still all was about the blockade and sanctioning at its most extreme level, which has cost them over $150 billion, which would go towards their impeccable healthcare system, go towards their impeccable educational system, and go towards the wonders that they deal with in the form of agriculture. So this is just an extension of that. And remember, for those of us who will never forget February 21st, 1965, when Malcolm was assassinated, April 4th, 1968, when Dr. King was assassinated, when Medgar Evers was assassinated, when Lumumba was assassinated, when Felix Mume was assassinated and poisoning in the Cameroon, they tried to assassinate Fidel Castro, Comandante Fidel Castro, 635 times. So assassinations, invasions, a continuation of imperialist adventurism.
Can you describe the sanctions and embargo facing Cuba? And can you also talk about how Israel and the United States are solely responsible for keeping this stranglehold on the Cuban economy in place?
The impact of the blockade has always been problematic. Cuba has a project with Venezuela called Operation Project Miracle, where Cuba was going around Venezuela and the rest of the Americas trying to eradicate glaucoma. And thousands of people got their eyesight restored that were blind, and people got their eyesight restored who were on the verge of getting blind. But because of the blockade, they're using Braille machines from the 1950s. When you talk about this in relationship to the public work system, the public transportation system, the healthcare system. Not having these incredible vaccinations, they'd established the Finlay Vaccination Institute during the corona pandemic. Yes, they were able to send 57 brigades to 40 nations, but it got to a point where they didn't even have syringes to utilize these vaccinations, of which they developed four. So it deals with the undermining of basic infrastructure, which in their case highlights the best attributes of their society. It compromises the educational system. It compromises the healthcare system. It compromises the agricultural system. It compromises public works. And the objective of this is to make the people submit. And remember what President Obama said during his inauguration: the might of our military must be matched by our diplomacy, meaning that if they cannot invade the nation, assassinate the leader, they'll starve the children, the women, and the men to death.
Since we have been under the Democratic Party presidency of Biden, how has Biden and the Democratic Party done in policies in regard to the Cuban people?
Biden is a Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy wannabe. Kennedy imposed the blockade. This is a blemish on the Democratic Party's record. Truman brought Israel into existence, brought the CIA into existence. So the fact that Zionist Israel is the only other nation in favor of the blockade on Cuba speaks volumes about who they are, what they represent, and the fact what Brother Malcolm X said, that Democrats are wolves and Republicans are foxes, and they both belong to the canine family. And then, of course, we have to turn attention to Senator Menendez, who's the chairman of foreign relations in the U.S. Senate. And he is the one who has maintained this hostile policy towards Cuba. And he's a Democrat. The extradition of Assad Shakur, he's been pushing for that. He claims that 7,000 Cuban medical personnel positioned throughout Africa, positioned throughout the Caribbean, positioned throughout Latin America, have been coerced by the United States to abandon their post and come here to be doctors. So even though the Henry Reed Medical Brigade has thousands of doctors in Africa, thousands of doctors in the Caribbean, thousands of doctors in Latin America, they take pride in the fact that they are undermining a brigade whose work is to give health care to the poorest people on this planet. So they are a multitude of examples that Biden letting Mad Dog Menendez run loose and do everything he can to use his hatred, his inherent hatred for Cuba, to maintain a policy of aggression, a policy of hostility. So you cannot talk about Biden without talking about Menendez and the Foreign Relations Committee and how they influence and manipulate Congress and how they manipulate the White House and how they manipulate think tanks, how they manipulate corporate media to justify a regime change agenda on Cuba, even though it's outdated, even though it's racist, even though it's terrorist.
Can you briefly describe the case of Assad Shakur, and can you tell us what is her status currently in Cuba?
Assad Shakur is formerly Joanne Chesimard, leader of the Black Liberation Army, in the leadership of the New York chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, who defended herself against naked police terrorism initiated by state troopers in 1973. She escapes from prison. After defending herself, she's charged with a murder, and she escapes from prison Underground Railroad style, and ever since her escape, Cuba has provided her asylum. But the United States, in response, put her on the FBI's terrorist list, placed a $2 million bounty on her head, and of course, this is tied to U.S. imperialism's efforts to put Cuba on the list of nations they accuse of state-sponsored terrorism, because even though that's very bogus, but at the heart of that hostility, at the heart of that vindictive measure, is Cuba's commitment to protecting Assad Shakur. And Cuba protecting Assad Shakur is an extension of them fighting in Angola with us for 14 years, being willing to send the 100 best guerrilla fighters to the Congo after Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, being willing to provide military assistance to us when we were fighting in Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Angola, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. Cuba fights with us in the hospitals. Cuba fights with us in the classrooms. Cuba fights with us on the battlefield. Cuba is an extension of the African personnel. And our fight to defend her is inextricably linked to the fight to get Cuba off the U.S. Department's, State Department's list of nations that they accuse of state-sponsored terrorism. They have Cuba mistaken with Zionist Israel. They have Cuba mistaken with the Congo under Mobutu, the Central African Republic under Bukasa, the Cameroon under Paul Biya, Nicaragua under Somoza, Haiti under Papa and Baby Doc. It's bogus. We fight.
What can people do to support the Cuban people and the Cuban revolution in this very dire time?
We today had a meeting with the deputy ambassador to the Cuban embassy, and we're going to create something called the African Ancestral and Diasporic Network on Cuba, where we will bring together African organizations in North America, South America, Central America, Latin America, the Caribbean, Europe, and Asia that believe that Cuba's territorial integrity should be defended. And once we get them together, we'll be able to look at who's doing work in the field of education with Cuba, who's doing work in the field of media with Cuba, churches and other religious and spiritual institutions that are doing work with Cuba, artistic and cultural institutions that are doing work with Cuba, everybody all across the board. And we will strengthen our ties, we will close our ranks, and we will defend Cuba's territorial integrity like never before. Organizations should be part of that effort right there.
For people that are involved in electoral politics, what is it that they can ask their elected officials?
They can follow your example, which you did in San Francisco, where you got the Board of Supervisors to pass a resolution. They've been multiple resolutions passed by city councils. The National Conference of Black State Legislators have stood up on this question. Mayors can develop sister city projects and not let the United States Agency for International Development undermine their efforts. The Congressional Black Caucus must intensify their efforts. We must do everything we can all the way across the board. What the African Ancestral Diasporic Network can do, we can get all the media together all over Africa, all over the Caribbean, all over Latin America to support Cuba, and we can develop a memorandum of understanding with Prensa Latina. We can get more churches to go to the Martin Luther King Center in Cuba and do humanitarian work. We can get artists to follow the example of M1 of Dead Prez and create material calling for the lifting of the blockade on Cuba. We can get documentarians to do more work around the impact that the blockade has had on everyday people in Cuba. But what we will do is all of these people who are doing this work anyway, we will go ahead and create an umbrella where they can be connected. And we will work with the friendship associations in Africa, me being part of one of them. But we will form memorandums of understanding with the National Network on Cuba and Vincent Ramos and those who do Cuba work full time. Because as we know, Africans have a multitude of problems. But when we come together for Cuba, we just want to maximize potential and be good daughters and sons of Africa. We thank you.
Well, thank you for your time, Obi.
Thank you.
That was J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio speaking to Obi Igbuna Jr.
Aquí pensaban seguir ganando el 100% con casas de apartamentos y echar al pueblo a sufrir y seguir de modo cruel contra el pueblo conspirando para seguirlo explotando y en eso llegó Fidel. Y se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Y se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Aquí pensaban seguir tragando y tragando tierra, sin sospechar que en la sierra se alumbraba el porvenir. Y seguir de modo cruel la costumbre del delito, hacer de Cuba un garito, y en eso llegó Fidel. Y se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Y se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar.
Carlos Puebla, y en eso llegó Fidel, and then Fidel came. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Next is part two of Thomas O'Rourke's interview with Garland Nixon, veteran broadcaster and current host on both Pacifica and Sputnik Radio. Part one of this interview first aired on our May 21st show.
Okay. I'm going to get into a sort of constitutional or legalese question with you. Are you familiar with the amicus brief that was filed in the presidential immunity case by none other than Edward Meese, former attorney general under Ronald Reagan, along with a bunch of California legal minds, that asserts, and very convincingly so, that Jack Smith is illegal. He's illegally appointed. He's not a special prosecutor because he is not a Article III officer, that is to say, appointed and nominated and appointed, or nominated and confirmed by the president and the Senate, that there are provisions for special types of lawyers in special cases, but he does not meet them. And I believe one of the opening questions that I heard in the oral arguments, Clarence Thomas asked about it. It was not touched afterwards, but he asked about this amicus brief. And I wouldn't be surprised to hear that the Supreme Court, you know, limits presidential immunity to some sort. And but at the same time, it even says Jack Smith's illegal. You're going to have to find a, you know, a real U.S. attorney to do this and lead the prosecutions in Florida as well as Washington, D.C. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, since I haven't read the amicus brief and I'm not as up on that as well as I should be, I can't say that it's right, wrong or indifferent. I can speak in more of a general sense. And that is that my belief on all of these cases is that it's lawfare, that there, that none of this really going. One of the, I think one of the issues that the prosecutions are having in this case, if in fact, I think a judge just ruled within the last few days that the Mar-a-Lago documents case is postponed indefinitely, yes. Right? Yes. One of the problems that they had was this was a shotgun approach. They were throwing as many charges as they could at Trump, hoping some of them would stick. The problem is that a lot of them, these charges and a lot of these legal theories that they use to go after Trump are dubious. And so a lot at best. And so a lot of them are dubious at best, malicious at worst, right? And so a lot of this stuff is going to fall through because when I'll give an example, Russiagate, which I know a lot about, they were just making up stuff, right? And one of the things they made up was that this Russian company was involved in some scheme to overthrow, through using a few Twitter and Facebook posts were going to change the election, right? And so they made we're going to charge them and blah blah blah, and we're going to, you know, knowing that this company's over there and, you know, you'll never have to go to trial with this. The company sent some lawyers over there and said, yeah, let's do this, let's have this trial. They had to throw everything out. Everything got thrown out. They dropped all the charges and said, oh yeah, we got to do this for national security. So the fact of the matter was they never expected to go to trial because it was trash. It wasn't a real case. And if it was, and I think the Russians company probably looked at it and said, yeah, you guys want to try this case? Let's do this. We'll get this cleaned up, right? Yeah, get real. They had to drop everything. Every motion that was made was damaged. They were getting torn apart on that because it wasn't a real case. They're going after Trump in every way they can. And a lot of the stuff is starting to fall apart because a lot of their legal theories were dubious at best. And any of it that falls apart won't shock me. There is some concern.
Let me interject. They also rely on corporate media to depict all of this in the most disfavorable light for obviously their political opponent, despite sort of logical reasoning. You know, they ask us to sort of just dispense with logic and our own critical thinking. And, you know, they're contributing to the dumbing down of this. But again, the theme is everything from a Democratic Party point of view is to be depicted in the most favorable light. Even their failures are failures of, you know, execution rather than intention because they're really with us, etc. I mean, that's all part of the, you know, the con game of American politics, correct?
You're absolutely 100% on the mark there. That you hit it. That it's team sports. Yeah. And my team's a good team. And the Cowboys fans are all stupid. I hate Cowboys fans. And the fans from my team are all good. We're good, smart, you know, good people. It's absurd. It's preposterous. But you're right. It's part of this team sports game. And now it gets to this. Anything I say against Donald Trump, because he's on the other team and he's on the other cult, any accusation I make against him must be taken as fact and it must be supported 100%. Any accusation that's made against a member of my team must be dismissed summarily and attacked And that's what it comes down to. You know, but there's something even more nefarious here. I had a caller who was actually honest. And this guy said, and because I basically made the case, I'm like, yeah, you know, come on. The guy literally, a man literally ran for office saying, if you elect me, I'll find something to charge Trump with.
Yeah.
He got elected and then he found something to charge Trump with. That's not justice. That's the definition of lawfare. The guy called in and he said, well, I don't care as long as they take Trump out by any means necessary. What he meant was this: I know and understand that they're just trying to take Trump out and this is lawfare. I don't like Trump, so I don't care. So they have now, you know, Bonapartism, right? When the ruling elite have arguments between each other and fights between each other, they try to recruit people from the working class to each of their teams, but they got to convince them that it's something in it for this. So now you got a guy who's been recruited to the team to say, we must take Trump out by any means necessary. I don't care. I don't believe in democracy. I'm pretty much basically a fascist, and I want the government to decide if it's somebody I don't like. I want the government to do whatever they can to take that person out so that person can't be president. There's a naivety there, believing that the government is on your side, they're doing it for you, and that at some point, that dynamic isn't going to turn against you. Yeah. I understand that eventually that dynamic comes back and turns against you. This guy doesn't. But understand, to me, people got to understand that there are a lot of people that do, in fact, understand that this is lawfare and support the fact that it's lawfare.
It was the Georgia case for me that really hit home some basic, some fundamental stakes that the working class needs to be made aware of. When I heard RICO being applied to an election contestation struggle, a conflict over the election results, my question to you is, the venal corruption in Fulton County, if it surprises you, do you really think it's significant? Touch on that. But it's RICO, which is Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, passed in 1970. By the way, is it appropriate in this case, given that the disputed election result is not exactly the textbook definition of an ongoing conspiracy by an ongoing criminal organization? And let me add this before you respond. Trade unions, historically, throughout the 19th and even well into the 20th century, were depicted as conspiracies. And thus were therefore illegal due to any number of violations or challenges they posed to capitalist liberal orders. Especially, it was overt in the 19th century. Challenges to property rights. Challenges to consumer rights or producer rights, improper or even immoral economic privileges, labor monopolies. Given the fact workers must try to unionize, have to breathe together, that is, conspire, and even keep secrets in the fight against owners and managers, how would you advise American workers to view RICO, given its use against the Teamsters back in the 90s when Ron Carey led a successful strike? Fannie Willis in DA in Fulton County herself used RICO to go after Atlanta area teachers in a testing scandal some 10 years ago. And more recently, and even just as egregiously, the Stop Cop City RICO indictments. Forest protesters trying to keep a cop training ground that has all kinds of corruption behind it, and the entire Atlanta establishment, political establishment, foisting it on a population that doesn't want it. What are your thoughts on that? RICO, how it's being used to target certain, you know, members of the ruling class, but its real target is the working class.
Absolutely. It's another tool of the ruling elite, another tool of the system to use for intimidation. You know, for people who don't know RICO, it kind of works like this. If I go out and commit a crime, okay, you can find me guilty of that crime. But if you find out, for instance, I commit a murder, you say, okay, we can give Garland whatever, 20 years for the murder, right? However, if I'm in the mafia or if I'm in another organization and that murder is committed for the benefit of this whole crime operation, it now becomes a RICO violation. And that's an additional crime. You give me another, it's an additional felony. Give me another 10 years, 20 years, whatever. Okay. So you can add that to it. If you say what Garland did was a crime, but it was in a furtherance of a much larger crime group, et cetera. Right. Okay. To me, the whole thing is preposterous with Trump, and this is something that will be used, you know, as we said, Stop Cop City. Now they're using it against protesters. They're using it against people who are protesting, saying, you know, in my community we get mistreated by the police, and we don't want this training facility. It's going to be in a wooded area. That's going to screw things up. It's good. Could they be shooting guns? And oh, we don't like this. We don't want this. And we're going to exercise our First Amendment rights to protest against it. And instead of just saying, okay, we're going to charge you with whatever they're going to charge them with, let's say it's trespassing or something, right? Not having a permit, who knows what? They're now saying it's in furtherance of a larger crime. Well, that's absurd. But that's a tool they're going to use.
Oh, financial support for people in jail was cut off. And, you know,
exactly.
They went after their bank accounts, just like they did in Canada.
And you can't help them. If you try to help them, well, I'm going to help that guy. Well, no, you can't do that, because that would be in furtherance of a crime, because he's acting in furtherance of a crime. So we're going to get you with a RICO Act also, right? But if you think about what they're charging Trump with, here's what's absurd about it. We found out during this whole Russiagate thing that there were numerous instances, innumerable instances, where they just simply lied, where they said, we know this is true, and we found out, where they literally hid things, where they went for years telling us, for years, they said the Russians broke into the DNC computers and stole some emails.
Yeah.
And they went on with this, on and on and on. And then we found out that in 2017, just after the election, Sean Henry, the only guy whose company actually looked at the DNC computers, testified under oath in front of Congress that he didn't know for sure that the Russians had hacked into the computer, that he wasn't sure, he didn't have evidence who it was, but he thought it was the Russians, and that no one removed anything from those computers. No one took any emails. So they told us the Russians took the emails. They gave them the Julian Assange. They did this with them, blah, 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 blah. But all the time, they knew that there was no evidence that anybody removed anything from their computers. And what did they do? They hid the documentation from that congressional hearing so no one would know it. Until the Republicans said, if you don't release it, we're going to. They finally released it. And then the media didn't touch it and say, wait a minute, you told us that they stole emails and no emails were stolen, right? I could go on and on where there was clear malice and aforethought during Russiagate, where they simply lied, continued to lie, and hid evidence, right?
And no one read the veterans intelligence professionals for what was
sanity exactly right
for sanity Ray McGovern, William Binney. They proved it was
that it was never a hack. So, but there were instance after instance, right? I could go one more. I got to go to 2020. The FBI gets a call from a guy in Delaware. Hey, I got a laptop. They go get the laptop. Hey, this laptop in 2019. This laptop belonged to Hunter Biden. They then check it against the cloud and they're like, it is Hunter Biden's laptop. And there's all this stuff on it. The FBI, knowing that they have Hunter Biden's laptop, then go to the media, they go to Twitter behind the scenes and they say, look, if anybody tells you that there's a Hunter Biden laptop out there and that it has bad stuff on it for Joe Biden, it's the Russians. And you have to, not only do you have to censor them, we'll help you censor them, right? They lied and they knew they were lying because they had a laptop and they knew it was Hunter Biden's laptop and they were afraid that it would get out. So they made it cooked up a lie for what? To interfere with the election. The FBI deliberately interfered with the election. Everything that they did was part of a RICO violation, wasn't it? That was a bigger plan to interfere with the election. Every crime they committed, they had a RICO charge there. None of them got charged with. They didn't get charged with election interference. Nobody got charged with RICO. So my point is, the whole thing's a scam.
And one man's racketeering conspiracy is another man's political campaign, just like one man's Mujahideen freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, right?
Right. Yes.
Depends
so to
on your point
understand
of view.
that, the whole idea that they're going after Trump for election interference is preposterous. And see, here's the problem. What happens in 2024, you know, whatever, if something happens? I'm a guy that never trusted the machines, right? I don't trust the machines. But they're setting up an environment where 2024, whoever wins, and they say, well, Garland, what do you think? And I say, well, I don't trust those machines, so I never trust the elections, because I could say it about a local election. I don't think the local dog catcher, you know, we had the machines, there was something weird with those. I don't trust the machine. A lot of people don't trust the machines, right? They can now charge me. They can now start going after people such as a radio talk show host that say, I don't trust any of the elections simply because I don't trust the machines. Well, we charge Trump, RICO, let's grab Garland and take him away in a black sedan.
That was Pacifica's Garland Nixon speaking to CRD's Thomas O'Rourke.
Want to talk about it? Colonize mine. Upload the devolution principle. You see a rock on the shore and say it's always been there. Download. No responsibility. Do what you want. Nobody cares. Upload the master race idea. Genetically disposed to rule the world. Download a future full of isolated. Full of isolated. Boys and girls, upload a two-party system. The lesser of two dangers, illusion of choice. Download a veiled form of fascism. Nothing really ever changed. You never had a voice.
Prince, Colonized Mind. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. This year is the 90th anniversary of the Minneapolis Teamsters General Strike in 1934. Artist and retired St. Cloud State University professor Keith Christensen talked with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the strike and the commemorations in Minneapolis.
This month is the 90th anniversary of the Minneapolis General Strike, the San Francisco General Strike, and also other strikes, Toledo Strike and other strikes in the United States. So it's a very important historic commemoration that's going on. And one of the commemorations is in Minneapolis. And we're joined by Keith Christensen. He's an emeritus professor at St. Cloud State University. And he's been involved with other artists, activists, trade unions in the Minneapolis area, St. Paul, commemorating this important historic strike. And they've been having a series of events during the month in Minneapolis and are trying to really bring to life those experiences, those lessons for working people today. So welcome to our show, Keith.
Thanks, Steve.
So Keith, why don't you talk, first of all, what was the 1934 General Strike?
Well, 90 years ago, the workers of this city got together and said, we're not going to take it anymore. They organized, and they were very creative about it, and they fought like hell. Some of them died. It was violent, but it was strategic, and it was effective, and damn it, they won.
And that strike was similar to San Francisco's general strike in that the government came in, the army was brought in. How was that strike successful? How were they successful facing the armed might of the state?
It's a good question about like how they did it. And it's kind of complicated, but I guess we could start with the fact that it was a time of need. The conditions were bad. It was during the Great Depression. People were desperate. They were starving, but they got organized, and they got organized from the bottom up. They had to kind of fight against the International Union, for one thing. They had to fight against the police, the National Guard, but they did it with creativity, with discipline, and with strategy and tactics. They organized a newspaper that was called The Organizer that documented the activities. They had young guys with motorcycles scour the city and stop the scabs and the strike breakers. And they had the women's auxiliary support them with the infirmary, because there was a lot of injuries and wounds caused by the police. But they also had a cafeteria and full support by families, by farmers. That's how they did it. They did it with solidarity. I think it ended technically after a long battle in August, when President Roosevelt sent an emissary with an eye on the election of the fall of 34, saying, "We've got to end this strike. It's really bad for the politics." And basically the banker said, "No, we're not going to negotiate with the dang union." And then Roosevelt said, sent an emissary to town and said, "Either you negotiate, you settle, or else we're calling in your dang loans." And within a week, the strike was settled. So there was all kinds of complications, but at the end of the day, it was solidarity with the workers and the effectiveness of their activities and the strike. Yeah.
And the employers at that time, the companies, said that they were communists. They wouldn't negotiate with communists. There were Trotskyists in the leadership of that strike, anti-communism. And same in San Francisco, actually, where they said the Reds had taken over San Francisco during the San Francisco general strike. That was the headline of the newspapers here.
I know. That was it. They thought the communists were atheists and they were rioting. Those were the characterizations of it. The newspapers were against the strike. But they had strategy. They had leadership by this Trotskyist, but it was also the farm labor, the liberals in it. It wasn't all 100% Trotskyist. The CP, the Stalinists, weren't much of a help, but the strategy of this Trotskyist, who were very aligned with the workers, even though they weren't aligned politically or ideologically. There was a lot of, empathy and solidarity between the guys with theory. James Cannon, who was the leader of the Trotskyists in America at the time, was a big part of it. Vincent Dunn, other prominent Trotskyists. But they had other guys like Bill Brown. He was the leader of the local strike, and he was not a Trotskyist, but they worked together. They worked together for the benefit of the workers and their families. And they had realistic goals, and they achieved them. They didn't go way violent. You know, they controlled themselves. There was reasonable goals, and they achieved them. So those are the lessons, I think.
And one of the things that was the case at that time is you had a very conservative union leadership, Tobin of the Teamsters, who was against the strike. And also, as well, in San Francisco, the San Francisco strike, you had the head of the ILA at that time who was against the San Francisco longshore strike. At that time, it was an ILA local. They later formed a new union, the International Longshore Workers Union. But in both cases, you had a conservative leadership, it seems, that did not want at all to have this kind of general strike action.
It was a pattern that the strikers, the workers, had to fight against the union as well as they did against the Citizens Alliance, was the group here in Minneapolis that was basically a brutal organization of what do you call it? Employers who were, they shut down Minnesota or Minneapolis from having a union for decades. That was one of the biggest obstacles too.
And you've decided in your committee, how did you decide that you were going to commemorate this by doing art and other activities? What was the decision that made you take that action?
Well, I've been a witness to the anniversary held here in Minneapolis since the 1990s, but I became involved in 2004. And it was actually inspiring for me to see young people have a street festival and a picnic and do all this promotional work around this revolutionary moment in 1934. And we had some hip hop artists perform and a band called The Strike from Chicago. And it was really uplifting. And we had art on the sides of the streets and blown up posters. It was really energizing. So I've been involved since 2004, but this year we planned on having an anniversary of the strike, but a number of us are creative folks. We have artists involved, as well as journalists, as well as lawyers, educators, and activists, and many, many union members. And not least of all were the descendants of the strikers, and those have been inspiring, those members of it. But it's been a real collective activity. It's been very non-hierarchical, and we've organized this this summer to have a number of events. We have exhibitions, we have film screenings, we have a memorial event in Minneapolis at the site of Bloody Friday. And then we have a picnic with speakers from all over the country who will be here. So we're it's kind of a gestalt, right? The whole is more than the sum of its parts.
Well, you have in the United States today a labor upsurge. Workers are organizing at Starbucks, Amazon, they're trying to organize.
That's right.
So it seems like young people today are facing a struggle to survive and are facing some of the same conditions where they're fired for trying to organize unions. So it seems that there are some similarities between the struggle then and the struggle today.
I'm glad you said that. The exhibit is called 1934 and Now, right? It includes different artists, including one, Brooks Turner, who did this 10-foot tall tapestry that's in the exhibit, and artists from Connecticut are in it. Mike Alowitz, another prominent labor artist, quite a range of folks and artists involved. So it wasn't about the dead history of 1934. It's about what's it got to do with today. We had a video made of Palestinian protest here in the Twin Cities, and some of the art was about the ongoing protest about the Palestinian situation and the war in Gaza that certainly relates to what happened in 1934. The police brutality that Minneapolis is infamous for with the George Floyd murder.
And that was a tremendous artistic expression too. They had a whole square there. It seems like Minneapolis has become a center of art and struggle and culture for people expressing themselves artistically about the struggles they face and the issues.
Yes, it's the zeitgeist, right? Portland, San Francisco, Minneapolis, we're in the same wavelength. You know, we feel it and we want to do something about it. And it's more than just one person. It's very much a grassroots effort.
That was artist and retired professor Keith Christensen on the 90th anniversary of the Minneapolis Teamsters General Strike. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Akua Holt, J.R. Valray, Thomas O'Rourke, Anne Garrison, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.